offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's Lotus Feet. Dear listeners, I welcome you to this week's episode of the Gita series, A Triumph Pilgrimage. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai, and it is my pleasure to welcome you from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. In this series, we go through the Bhagavad Gita verse by verse, and we've had the opportunity and the pleasure of going through the first four chapters. We just started the fifth chapter a couple of weeks back, and so we are in the early few verses of that chapter, and this chapter is about sannyasi yoga, but pretty much one of the things that we would see, as we'll be seeing more this week, is that there is not much difference from what Krishna is saying here than what he said about a karma yogi, and that is for good reason, as we will see. But as always, let's begin by going through the verses that we covered last time, and we'll take it on from there. We covered four verses last week, verses 3, 4, 5, and 6 of the fifth chapter. In the third verse of the fifth chapter, Krishna says how even a sannyasi will be freed from attachment only when he breaks from likes and dislikes. Krishna doesn't use the word raga and dvesha, he uses the word dislike. He says dveshti, or hatred, which is a more appropriate translation of that word. And instead of raga or attachment, he uses the word kankshati, or being attracted towards. But essentially, that's the whole idea of raga and dvesha, has to be removed from the mind, even in the case of a sannyasi. We saw how Krishna was indicating that sannyasa should not be a result of any momentary fancy or a disgust. Because when he says that only when one breaks free from likes and dislikes, one can contemplate a life of sannyasa, it means that one having a momentary fancy or momentary dispassion because one doesn't like in the case of Arjuna, that should not be the reason why one is propelled to take a life of sannyasa. I think that is one of the understandings that we drew from that shloka that Krishna said. And for conquering raga and dvesha, the path of karma yoga is an ideal tool. In the fourth verse, Krishna goes back to reiterating that the two paths of sankhya or sannyasa and yoga, he constantly uses the word yoga, but what is being referred to is karma yoga. So sankhya and karma yoga are two inseparable pathways. He says only the childish or the childish in understanding will think that the two paths are separate. And he goes on to add that if one takes to any one path, the rewards of both the paths will be attained. But one must be sincere in the path that has been taken. Ekam api astitaha. Take any one, but be astitaha, or firm in that path, which means be sincere and diligent in the path that has been chosen. In the fifth verse, he repeats the statement by saying that the state that a sankhya reaches will be reached by a yogi as well. And only he sees who sees the two as one. Only he sees who sees sankhya and karma yoga as one. So it's a reiteration of what Krishna said in the fourth verse. In the sixth verse, Krishna states that even though these two paths are inseparable, after having made that very, very clear, he goes on to say that from the point of view, in what way they are inseparable? From the point of view that both take you to the goal. The whole idea is to reach the goal. The whole idea is to acquire jnana, and that is supreme in the mind. It doesn't matter whether you're wearing an ochre robe or you're wearing royal garments. So in that sense, when the goal is supreme, that makes these two paths, which both have the ability to take you to the goal, as inseparable from that point of view. But he stresses in the sixth verse that even for sannyasa, the mind has to be prepared through karma yoga. People who wish to propagate the path of sannyasa say, from this statement, that so karma yoga leads to sannyasa, and that means sannyasa is a more advanced stage, whereas karma yoga is a more preliminary stage. But because Krishna states here, and you can make out from the tone of the shloka itself, that even a sannyasi must be a yogi, those who propagate the path of karma yoga tend to say that karma yoga is fundamental and karma yoga is essential. One may or may not be a sannyasi, but it is very essential for one to be a karma yogi. But the fact is, they are inseparable, and the difference is only in the mind of the ignorant. The one who are intelligent, the one who have the knowledge will know that these two paths are inseparable. And one of the points that I made last week was that for all that we know, we might be going through these paths in turns. That I might be a karma yogi this time and gain what has to be gained through the path of karma yoga. There might be the next birth, I might be a sannyasi, and who knows, the birth after that, I might come back to a path of karma yoga. It is almost like what is required for the mind, the soul chooses and undergoes that experience. So in that sense, this debate of which is higher or which is more superior is quite absurd. There is another subtle point about the shloka, but I think we'll take it up as part of the explanation for the next shloka. We'll listen to that. And as always, it is in the voice of Brother Shyam, to whom we are very grateful. We will listen to that shloka. This is shloka number 7 of chapter 5. I will give you a brief meaning of that, and then we will discuss in detail.
Yoga yukto vishuddhatma vijitatma jitendriyah sarva bhutatma bhutatma kurvannapi nalipyate.
A master of yoga whose self is very pure and is fully subdued, the sense organs controlled, and the soul is realized to be the soul of all beings, he is not stained even though he is a performer of actions. So that is the 7th shloka of the 5th chapter. In the previous shloka, Krishna had very categorically said that it is not easy to reach and maybe even not easy to retain the state of sannyasa without the preparation of karma yoga. But for one whose mind is prepared through karma yoga, Brahman is easily attainable, right? That's what he had said in the previous verse. So there's an important point that Krishna is making in this shloka, not in this shloka, the previous shloka. We'll take it on from there, as I just said in the introduction. This point is not easy to miss, and if at all you've missed it, let me mention it and bring it to your notice. In the first line, Krishna says, sannyasa is difficult to attain for one who is not a karma yogi, but for a master of karma yoga, Brahman is easily attainable. So the first line he speaks about sannyasa being difficult to attain, but in the second line he speaks about attaining Brahman. If it is a regular statement of comparison, Krishna should have said, without karma yoga, sannyasa is difficult. With karma yoga, sannyasa is easy, right? That is a straight comparison that you would expect. But here he mentions sannyasa in the first line and speaks about reaching Brahman in the second line, which means a perfect sannyasi is one who reaches Brahman, right? That's a no-brainer. Just as a perfect karma yogi reaches Brahman, which Krishna has been saying so much in the 3rd and 4th chapter. And in fact, later Krishna will say how even a perfect devotee or a perfect bhakta reaches Brahman too. In other words, be it a sannyasi or a karma yogi, when you follow the path sincerely, one will eventually reach the same divinity or jnana. This is not something new I've derived at and saying that, oh, this is my discovery. Krishna has said it in the 5th shloka. We discussed that last week, and he said so in the beginning of the 3rd chapter as well. And what this means to us at this point is, when Krishna spoke of the jnani in the 4th chapter, and he gave the description of a karma yogi we saw before that, and maybe even in the state when in his description of sthita prajna in the 2nd chapter, all of these descriptions are going to be very, very similar, and that is the point I'm trying to make. The interesting thing about this shloka and the next few is like, it is almost like a preview of the spiritual journey itself, almost like speaking of the sequence of events. And this I'm referring to the shloka that we just heard. Because when I read out the meaning, it is not difficult to miss that the description is very, very similar to the description of a Karma Yogi, the description of a Sthita Prajna, and it is going to be very, very, very similar to the description of a Bhakta, which is going to come in the later chapters. But this particular shloka, if you look at it, it is almost like it is giving you the stepwise journey or the sequence of events in the spiritual journey. It may or may not be in the order mentioned, and it is not like you finish this leg of the journey and then the other starts. But nevertheless, you can kind of sense an idea of progression that is being hinted at in this particular shloka. Krishna had said in the previous shloka, yoga yukto munihi brahma nachirena adhigacchati. And that's what he had said in the fourth verse. I'm sorry, that's what he had said in the sixth verse. What we went through is the seventh verse. In the sixth verse, he had made the statement, yoga yukto munihi brahma nachirena adhigacchati. Yoga yukta, or one who is devoted to karma yoga, it's another adjective for that, reaches Brahman without much delay. Nachirena, without much delay, adhigacchati, he reaches. Now, Krishna is going to say, what happens to the individual after becoming a karma yogi till he or she becomes a jnani? So in this shloka he says, yoga yukto, again, the yoga yukta, vishuddhatma, a purified individual, vijitatma, a self-conquered individual, jitendriyaha, a master of the senses, sarva-bhutatma bhutatma, one who is self, is the self in all, kurvannapi na lipyate. Even though he acts, he is not tainted. If you look at all of these words that I just read out, vishuddhatma, vijitatma, jitendriya, these all seem like adjectives, right? He's defining or explaining the state of a yoga yukta in as many words. But if you look at it as stages in the journey, as I was just saying, it's like a progression. He first says the yoga yukta becomes a vishuddhatma. First of all, in this journey, what happens to us is we become a pure person. This is the fundamental point. When I am a true karma yogi, I will not entertain ideas of hurting or harming another person. I will do my duty. I will be content. I will be less greedy, more peaceful, more helpful, less selfish. Think of it, whatever you would like to mention there in this line as your definition of a good person. That state will be reached if one person leads a life of being a good karma yogi. And this is the least expected. So goodness becomes one's nature in this first state that will be reached. And the other thing is, the word atma is used to denote different instrumentalities of life in this particular shloka, not just the soul. And in fact, it has happened many times before in the Gita too. Whenever Krishna says atma, it is not necessarily the supreme soul, atma. The word atma also means self, right? Myself, when I say that in English in a very colloquial sense, even for that, the word used in Sanskrit is atma. So when you say atma, it means multiple things, as we will see in this particular shloka. So that word atma does not necessarily mean only atma. So when Krishna says vishuddhatma, it is not the atma, because atma needs no purification. It is divine. It is absolutely perfect and pure as it is. What requires purification? It is the mind that undergoes purification. all our flaws are in the mind. So we become pure in our minds as a result of following Karma Yoga. Right? This is again something that Krishna has mentioned so many times. The path of Karma Yoga leads to Antakarana Shuddhi or Chitta Shuddhi, which is another word for purification of the inner instruments or the mind, which will prepare the mind to receive the jnana. So first stage, he says, is Yoga Yuktaha Vishuddhatma. The one who is sincere in the path of Karma Yoga becomes a pure individual. Then he says, Vijitatma Jitendriyaha. Now again, in Vijitatma, the word Atma can be said to denote the body. So Vijitatma means the one who has the body under control, or literally one who has conquered one's own body. And Jitendriya means one who has conquered the senses. Indriya means senses. So going back to what Arjuna had asked in the third chapter, he asked, even if I have good thoughts, what makes me do the wrong things? Which means it is not enough if I am a good person. I must have mastery over my jnanendriyas and karmendriyas, the sense organs and the organs of action, so that I can express that goodness. Say I am driving a car. I might be a very good man who doesn't like to harm anyone, right? That's my nature. But then if I don't have control over the car, then how can I guarantee that I will not harm anyone, even though I do not have any wrong intentions? In the same way, we might be very good people in the core, but when we are, as Krishna himself explained, hit by rajasic impulses from outside, when we are angered by others, when we are hit by a very strong lustful impulse from outside, we become a different person altogether. And at that time, this good person within us is like a good man in a car that he has no control over. So goodness without self-control is not good enough, if I could put it that way. And that is why a Karma Yogi becomes a Vishuddhatma, but then he should also become a Vijitatma Jitendriyaha. He should be a master of his body and he should be a master of his senses. His goodness, he should be able to act on it and live by that. The next adjective, which, as I said, can be again seen as the next stage one reaches in this path, is a very, very beautiful phrase that Krishna uses. He says, Sarva Bhutatma Bhutatma. It means one whose self has become the self in all beings. And now here Atma refers to the higher self. It's beautifully worded, isn't it? One whose self has now become the self in all beings. Sarva Bhutatma Bhutatma. And Adi Shankara in his commentary says, when we say all beings, it means from Brahma to even a tuft of grass. The Atma in me, if you look at it, is always one with the Atma in all beings. It does not become one, right? Because that is the whole truth, as we have been saying. The truth is, there's only one self. That self is common in everyone, and that self is divine. This is the truth, and this is the truth we are trying to realize. So it doesn't necessarily become one with everybody else, but when realization dawns, I now begin to see that self in me is the same as the self in all. That ignorance that was blocking this truth now goes away after I have performed Karma Yoga and attained purity of mind and complete self-control. In fact, this morning when we were discussing in the afternoon satsang, we were talking about that one statement that Swami makes about doing one's karma and doing one's duties, when Hislop raised the question about what is dharma and why is it important to follow it. Swami made this very same statement, and I was very surprised to see that there, and I did mention this, because the same thing which Krishna is saying here, when you've been a good karma yogi, you'll become a pure person, and that pure person will have self-control, which means control of the body and the senses, and he will begin to see his own self in the self of all beings. And that's precisely what Swami had said in that conversation. Swami said, you will start feeling others' pain as your own. You will start experiencing others' experiences as your own. It's a different way of just saying Sarva Bhutatma Bhutatma. So very, very important step and a very beautifully worded phrase. If we also look at it, this is quite similar to what Krishna said in the fourth chapter. You will see all beings in your own self. And of course he goes on to say that you will see your own self in me. But this point had been made even in that fourth chapter. So as I said, all these points have been mentioned already. But Krishna is now saying it in the context of a sannyasi. He had mentioned it in the context of a sthita prajna. He mentioned it in the context of a karma yogi. He mentioned it in the context of a jnani. Now he is mentioning it in the context of a sannyasi. Because perfection in all of these paths leads to the same purification of the mind. So Krishna is giving the past and the future of a sannyasi and also saying that at one point the line vanishes. And when the line vanishes, it doesn't matter whether you're a sannyasi or a karma yogi or whatever is the path that you've taken. So that is the critical point that is being made here, and it is being made repeatedly because it is very easy for us to look at these as different. At a certain point in the journey, a karma yogi becomes a sannyasi automatically, right? That's one of the points, that is one of the lessons that he is trying to derive through this whole thing. So some part of a karma yogi has to be inculcated in one's life for the purification of the mind. So a sannyasi might give up his duties towards the family that he was born in, but even a sannyasi would take up some other form of karma yoga, some other means by which one serves the society and serves and performs those actions as a karma yogi would perform his actions towards one's own family in that sense. Excuse me. Next we'll take up two shlokas, shloka number 8 and 9, because it is one continuous statement that Krishna is making. And in a way he is going to expand a very small point that he made in the shloka that we have just gone through. So we listen to the shlokas 8 and 9, one after the other. I'll give you the meaning for them as one statement, because as I said, they are one statement being split into two shlokas. So we'll listen to the shlokas, I'll give you the meaning, and then we'll discuss in detail.
Naiva kinchit karomiti yukto manyeta tattvavit pashyan shrinvan sprishan jighran ashnan gachan swapanshvasan pralapan visrajan grihyan unmishan nimishannapi indriyani indriyartheshu vartanta iti dharayan.
Remaining absorbed in the self, the knower of reality thinks, I certainly do not do anything, even while seeing, hearing, touching, smelling, eating, moving, sleeping, breathing, speaking, releasing, holding, opening, and closing the eyes, remembering that the organs function in relation to the objects of the organs. So these were verses 8 and 9, and as I said, it is one long statement which has been broken into two shlokas. Krishna ended the previous shloka by saying, Kurvannapi na lipyate. Even while acting, there is no taint. And here, the taint being referred to is consequences of the karmas that is being performed. So in these two shlokas, Krishna elaborates that kurvan, that doing, what all that kurvan or the act of doing includes. He says, pashyan, seeing, shrunvan, hearing, sprishan, touching, jighran, smelling, ashnan, eating, gachan, going, swapan, sleeping, shvasan, breathing, pralapan, speaking, Visarjan, letting go. Grihanan, seizing. Unmishan, opening. Nimishan, closing. The opening and closing was, of course, in reference to the eyes. So as we can see, the list is pretty exhaustive, right? It covers all the actions that one may perform through the senses and the body, and all the actions that are either voluntary or involuntary, and all the actions that are required for the sustenance of the body, as well as progression of one's dharma or one's duty in life. So he says, Na eva kinchit karomi. I do not do any of this. Iti manyeta. He thinks like this. Yuktaha tattvavita. The yukta who is the knower of the truth. So when Krishna said kurvan in the previous verse, it is in present continuous tense, which means even as one is doing, there is no taint. And continuing that, he says in the shloka that even as one is seeing, eating, doing, releasing, holding, and whatever all those actions that he mentions, etc., etc., he thinks or he remembers that whatever he is doing, he doesn't do. Na eva kinchit karomi. I am not doing any of this. Right? So he says a yoga yukta remembers that at all times when he is performing all of these actions. So here Krishna uses the term tattvavita, the knower of the truth. So he is describing the same person whom he described as sarvabhutatma bhutatma, one whose self is the self in all, which means that is the truth. The truth is that myself is the same as the self in all beings. So one who knows that truth is a tattvavita, knower of that truth. And that tattvavita continues to do all actions, but firmly knows or believes that he is not the doer. Why? Because kartritva or doership has been completely given up. The ahankara has been sublimated. So there is no doer at all. But he or she still acts after reaching this understanding. If they don't see their actions as their own doing, then how would they perceive their actions? How are they seeing their actions? Towards the end of that second shloka, Krishna says, Indriyani indriyartheshu vartante. The senses are engaged in the objects of the senses, iti dharayan, being thus convinced. Which means the body with its organs acts on whatever it must act, acts as it must act. The individual doesn't attach oneself to it. The yuktaha tattvavita acts in a manner of fact. If that's probably the best way to put it. You know, he acts with common sense. When the body has to sleep, he lets the body sleep. When the body has to eat, he lets the body eat. But he does not ever get convinced or get deluded that he is the one who is doing it or she is the one who is doing it. Right? So when the body needs whatever it needs, the body, and that's the essence of that particular statement. Indriyani indriyartheshu vartante. The senses interact with the sense objects, and I have nothing to do with that. So as you can very clearly see, these ideas might seem very repetitive. These very same statements were made in different examples, and different words were being used to convey the same idea. But I feel these are so important to be repeated again and again to remove some of the very, very deep-rooted misconceptions that many of us seem to develop about spirituality. When we say, I am not the body, that statement can be endlessly misrepresented. And almost without fail, I think we all have misrepresented it and misinterpreted it at some time in our life, in some time in this journey of spirituality. So we think spirituality is about mastering the body in such a manner that it cannot be harmed by the elements, it cannot be harmed by hunger. We think that we are not the body, so we can subsist on sunlight, go without eating for days, we can go without sleeping for days. Yes, there may be many great yogis and saints and sannyasis living in the Himalayas who have such siddhis. But if you really look at it, you know, just look at these few verses that we have gone through. Krishna is describing a sannyasi, Krishna is describing a karma yogi, and we can see that how similar all of that is. Anywhere does Krishna say that these powers have to be acquired? Anywhere does Krishna speak about such supernatural siddhis being acquired by a jnani or by a sannyasi or by a yogi? There may be, as I said, there may be people who acquire these siddhis. There might be some great yogis. We read about them in the books and all of that. For instance, let's say that, you know, one person chooses to be an athlete, or somebody chooses to be an art, you know, a master of art or master of music. An athlete, a musician, can become a jnani. But can we say that to become an athlete and to become a musician is essential to become a jnani? We will not say that, right? A very good musician can become a great devotee, but we will never say to learn music is essential to become a devotee. In whatever we do, we can become a karma yogi, we can become a jnani, and we can reach these different states that Krishna is speaking about. In the same way, I think even in spirituality, the path as such is very simple. There might be some people who go through the spiritual path and who attain some great siddhis and great powers. They might read your mind. They might be able to materialize objects. But if you ask, are these powers and are these experiences that one has essential for the spiritual path, essential for one to become a jnani? It is not. The path of spirituality is extremely simple, and I think that is why Krishna is repeatedly mentioning it again and again and again, because it is so simple that it may be too bland for many of us, and it is, it does not interest us, or maybe we can get distracted by the various other pathways which can distract us within the spiritual journey itself. So Krishna is reiterating it and reminding us again and again, it's very, very simple. It is not simple to achieve. It will take maybe lifetimes to become even a faltering karma yogi. We can then take a guess how many more lifetimes it might take to become a perfect karma yogi, and very quickly you become a jnani after that, as Swami said. How many lifetimes it will take? In that sense, the path is not simple. But, and as Swami would say, very few take to the spiritual path, because Krishna had mentioned this in one of the previous shlokas. He said, because what can be achieved through karma in the worldly frame is like a low-hanging fruit, right? When that is so easily accessible, why would you go after the spiritual goals which are more difficult to attain? So in that sense, the spiritual path is not simple, but it is simple by nature. What is spirituality really? I should be a karma yogi. What does that mean? I must do my duty with least expectations as possible. And I must continue to do it even if I feel unrewarded, unrecognized, or if I'm not growing, I'm not becoming better. I stick to my duty. That duty can be anything from sweeping the streets to ruling the land. Then I should have a pure heart. I should become, as Krishna said, a Vishuddhatma. And Swami says, I should help ever, hurt never. As simple as that. I should have control over my body, senses and the mind. Then I will begin to see myself in every person I interact with. And eventually I will realize that there is only one self, and that self is divine. And when all this happens, I will act, but I will have the firm belief that the body acts, I do not. So spirituality is as straightforward and simple as that. Forget about the world distracting us. I think there is enough in the name of spirituality to distract us, if you really look at it. we think that we will one day be able to read others' thoughts, we will be able to heal others, or we will be able to talk to Swami in our meditation and help others. I'm not dismissing all of these powers or experiences that one might have. I'm no one to comment on others' experience. I do not have the authority, nor do I have the knowledge to do that. All I'm saying is, if you and I wish to walk on the spiritual path, these are the only valid milestones that we have to look forward to. Everything else is only a fancy. Someone craves for worldly pleasurable experiences. We will probably be craving for spiritually pleasurable experiences. If we need that experience for our spiritual progress, if at all we need that experience of, you know, one day, many, many devotees of Swami have had that experience of seeing their own self in everyone, right? It's like a tangible experience that they have. If we need that experience for our spiritual progress, most certainly Swami is going to give it to us. There's no doubt about that. But otherwise, I think it is not mandatory in the spiritual journey for everyone to have that experience, at least from what Krishna has been saying all this while. These experiences are not as mandatory as self-control is, equanimity is, love for all beings is, as Swami would say, sarva bhuta prema. In fact, the statement that Krishna made in the previous shloka, sarva bhutatma bhutatma, is in fact translated by some of the commentators as one who is able to love all beings as one loves oneself. So these are the milestones to look out for and achieve in the spiritual path. Let us not worry that, oh, Swami, I've been doing bhajans for so many years, I've been doing meditation for so many years, I've not had an experience, I've not had the darshan, jyoti darshan, I've not had this darshan, I've not had communion with you. I am not dismissing any of these prayers, I'm not saying that don't ask for all of these things, but these are not the milestones in the spiritual journey. The milestones in the spiritual journey are what Krishna just mentioned in these shlokas. And here Krishna is saying that these are the milestones even in the life of a sannyasi. Even if you become a monk, even if you run away to the Himalayas and you say that I'm going to sit in a cave and meditate, even then, these are the milestones. These are the milestones in the path of a karma yogi. These are the milestones in the path of a sannyasi. And eventually we'll see that these are the very same milestones even in the path of one who takes to devotion or bhakti. So I think this is a very, very important point that Krishna is making. And as spiritual aspirants, it is always important to remember this. I know it is so simple that it becomes bland and boring sometimes. But then the whole idea is to remain focused and not get distracted. Right? And Swami's explanations are so very simple, just like the Bhagavad Gita. And that is why the Bhagavad Gita is so precious. You know, even though it is an esoteric verse, even though it is about spirituality, it is, if I could use that term, it is hardcore spirituality, but nevertheless, it is so simple, direct, and it is, as we have said many, many times, it is a sadhana prasthana. It is a scripture that is meant for practice right away. Tomorrow you can get up and become a sannyasi. Not in the sense that you can leave your family and go, but sannyasi in the sense that Krishna has been explaining here. A true karma yogi who is also a sannyasi, right? We can start doing our business that we are doing for many, many years in this way that Krishna is telling here. You've been a musician, tomorrow you can start becoming a karma yogi musician. And I think that is the beauty of this entire work. It is making the spiritual path accessible to every one of us. So we'll go to the next verse, which is verse number 10. We will listen to that and then we will discuss about the meaning in detail.
Brahmanyadhaya karmani sangam tyatva karoti yaha lipyatena sapapena padma patramivambhasa.
Who performs actions by offering them to Brahman and giving up attachment, he is not stained by sin. Just as the lotus leaf is not stained by water. So that is the 10th verse of the 5th chapter. In this verse and the next few verses that we'll be going through, maybe we'll have time for one more to listen to it. But the verses that are going to follow, Krishna is going back to the description of a karma yogi. Or in other words, he speaks about karma sannyasa from the point of view of a karma yogi. He said that one is a tattvavita, one who is a sarvabhutatma bhutatma, such a person is not stained by actions. I think we all can agree upon that. We have spoken about it many times where the tattvadarshi or tattvavita, who knows that the same self is in everyone, he does not associate himself or herself with the mind, one does not associate oneself with the ahankara, and so there is no katratva. We have spoken about all of that, right? So when Krishna says the tattvavita does not get stained by actions, we do not have any qualms with that. We'll very clearly accept that. But my problem is, I am not there yet. I am not yet a tattvavit. I don't know the truth, or I don't know the truth the way I'm supposed to know it. Such a person would not even care about the Gita. One who has understood that the same self resides in all other beings, he probably will not be listening to the Gita series, or will not be reading the Gita or the Vahini series or any of those things. He does not need any spiritual discourse at all. That is why Krishna, time and again, will come to the level of the sadhaka, come to the level of you and me, and say what we can do. As I just said, the whole text of the Gita is meant to be put into practice, right? It is not about reading it. It is not about giving a discourse on it like I'm doing, or listening to it. It is about putting it into practice. And that is why, after saying that for a tattvavita, for a yoga yukta, for a jnani, it is like this, Krishna will always bring it down to the level of you and me so that we can act on that. So this shloka is one of those shlokas where Krishna again shifts back to a karma yogi so that there is something for us to pick up and act on. Because now he speaks about offering one's actions to God. He says, Brahmani in Brahman, Adhaya, having placed Karmani, all actions. He says, this is what he is talking about, the Karma Yoga, the Karma Yogi. He says, Brahmani Adhaya Karmani, having placed all actions in Brahman. Right? That's the first statement. We'll come to the remaining. But if I am going to see myself in all beings, and as Adi Shankara said in his commentary, from Brahma to a tuft of grass, where is the question of me making an offering to Brahman? Where is the question of me saying that here is God in front of me, or here is Swami in front of me, and I am a devotee, and I am the offerer, and I am making an offering to Swami? That is why this shloka is for the sadhaka, who is not yet there, right? Which means you and me. Hopefully Swami will at least consider us as karma yogis and sadhagas, right? If there are some jnanis in the audience, please forgive me. This is not a reference to you. So Krishna says, Yaha brahmanyadhaya karmani, one who offers all actions to God, sangam tyaktva karoti, and acts giving up all attachment. Lipyate nasa papena. He is not tainted by sin. Now this, what Krishna is saying, is a huge assurance that is being given to all of us. It is understandable, as I said, if a jnani will not be tainted by consequences because he is established in the truth, he or she is an akarta, a non-doer, does not have an ego. But here Krishna is saying, even if you are a karma yogi or a devotee, Because this feeling of doing as an offering to God is absolutely out of question if there is no devotion, right? So even if you're a karma yogi or a bhakta who is still caught up in this duality of life, if you are able to do all actions, what was mentioned in the previous shloka, from small acts to one's big responsibilities, as an offering to God, even then, sin will not attach to you. How? Padma Patram Iva Ambasa. Like the lotus is not touched by water. I'm still at a state where I see the lotus and the water it is growing in as being separate. But at least the water now cannot taint me. That is why Swami would often say, just as the lotus plant lives in water but does not get contaminated by it, so we should live in the world but be untouched by it. This is another central recurring teaching or theme of the Bhagavad Gita. Do whatever you do as an offering to God. We've discussed what it means to do all actions as an offering to God, and I'm sure this will not be the last time that we'll be discussing about it. It's going to come again and again in the future, shlokas and chapters too. But nevertheless, now that Krishna is speaking about making an offering to God or making all actions as an offering to God, let us take the opportunity to reiterate it for ourselves. Krishna says here, Yaha Brahmanyadhaya Karmani Sangam Tyaktva Karoti. The act of offering actions to God and acting without attachment is somewhat related, right? That's what Krishna is saying here. One will act as all actions are offering to God, and Sangam Tyaktva Karoti. He will do it with no attachment at all. Now imagine for a moment that you are standing in your puja room and you're offering prayers to Swami. Or let us say that you go into your garden and you say that, let me pluck a flower for Swami and let me place it at Swami's altar. To some of these acts where we interact with Swami, we make an offering of a prayer or make an offering of a flower, no one else is a witness to that exchange. What I pray to Swami is just between me and Swami. The flower I offer to Swami, though only Swami will see it before it fades, I will still go out into the garden and get the most beautiful flower. Of course, these days we take pictures of even that flower that we offer to Swami and put it on social media, but you know, that's a different point altogether. But faith is supposed to be something that is always one-to-one between you and Swami, and it is supposed to be a very private and intimate thing. The point I'm trying to make is, there is no show, there is no fear of judgment, there is no seeking approval from any other person in an act of offering. It is possible that we may follow rituals, right? Even in that offering of standing in front of Swami in the altar and praying and all that, we might follow rituals, but still, we alone are the witness to the fact whether we are doing it in the right way or not. Now, imagine the same thing. What happens if we are able to translate that to all the actions that we perform? Imagine doing all acts as a simple act of devotion of offering a flower to God. Just as I will pluck the most beautiful flower in the garden, I will not pick any flower that is probably badly formed or it has been half eaten by ants or it has fallen down. Right? I'm not going to pick any of those flowers. I've gone into the garden. I most certainly look for the most well-bloomed and, you know, symmetrical looking, the most beautiful colored flower. No one is going to come and pat my back and say, oh, you've chosen a nice flower, right? Still, if I go into the garden to pick a flower for Swami, I will pick the best flower. And I think I would not be wrong in representing all of you, right? Anybody, any of you who want to offer a flower from your garden to Swami at your altar, will do this, right? When you go out into the garden, you look for the most beautiful flower. You will not look for any deformed flower or anything like that. even if nobody is going to see it, even if nobody is going to appreciate you, you will always pick the best flower. Day after day, the flower I keep in my altar might fade, but still, the next day if I go to the garden to pluck a flower for Swami, I will still look for the most beautiful flower and pluck it and offer it to Swami. The same will happen to all my actions. I will always try to do my best. I will always strive every day to become better than what I was the previous day. And in this offering that I'm making, I don't need anyone else's appreciation. I don't need anyone else's approval, nor do I seek any reward. When you perform your duty of a mother this way, your children may or may not be grateful to you, right? It's possible that a few years later the children don't really recognize how much sacrifices you've done. But it will not matter as much to you because you did not do it for their gratitude. You were only offering a flower to Swami and it had to be perfect. For the job that you do in your office, you may get a promotion, you may not get a promotion, your boss may appreciate you, or for all the good work that you've done, you may be yelled at. But still the next day when you go to your office, you will come and do your job perfectly. Why? Because you're not working for a raise or promotion. You're not working to please the boss. You are offering a flower to Swami. And that flower has to be perfect and beautiful. So if we are trying to follow this simple technique of offering all our actions to Swami, one of the best ways to see if we are growing in this path of offering all our actions to Swami, we can see whether we depend lesser and lesser on the rewards and the appreciation from outside. Negative comments, negative reactions, or even positive comments and positive reactions will distract us less and less from continuing to do our best. The moment we feel unrewarded, the moment we feel underappreciated, our thoughts will immediately go, but I did not do this for this appreciation. I did not do this because my boss is going to come and tell me that, oh, you did a good job. I was only offering a flower to Swami and I was only ensuring that that flower is the most perfect one I can place in front of Swami. Right? I did it for my Swami and I just ensured it was going to be perfect. Tomorrow, if nobody is going to come and appreciate me for that, it doesn't matter because I did not do it for that. And that is why this act of offering to Swami and detachment from the consequences are inseparable. Yah Brahman Yadhaya Karmani, one who offers all actions to Brahman, Sangam Tyaktva Karoti, will act without any attachment. Of course, this is not easy. Just because I'm saying it, it does not mean that it's so easy and I'm practicing it every day. It is not easy, right? Let's be honest. We all need positive reinforcements. We all need some kind of feedback from the people we are involved in with our work. As a speaker, I would certainly like to know if my words are making sense to my audience. As a teacher, you might want to know if the students benefit. If you're a boss, if you're a team leader, you want to know if those working under you are able to grow under your leadership, right? And this feedback is most certainly essential for us as long as we have a mind, because the mind needs this kind of, it's food for the mind, this kind of appreciation, this kind of acceptance from peers. That is food for the mind. And as long as there is a mind, the mind will need these things. But remember, when we say that whatever I'm acting and whatever I'm doing it as an offering to Swami. Swami is not just a picture, right? Swami will then become completely involved with our life. The duty of taking us to the goal will now, it is always His, right? We have not reached out to Him and asked Him that we want the goal. We've asked Him for all kinds of things and trinkets. We have not asked Him to be a companion in this path. So He's only waiting for that call, and He's definitely going to be the one who is going to take the responsibility of taking us to the goal. So He will ensure that the mind is given what it needs to remain positive and hopeful. So if it calls for appreciation once in a while, if it calls for success once in a while, if it calls for recognition once in a while, I think it will come as and when Swami chooses that this mind needs a little bit of pampering right now, right? But we, for our part, should never become too attached to the consequences. When Krishna was defining the jnani, he had said, Tyaktva karma phalam asangam. He has given up deep attachment. Asangam is not merely attachment, but deep attachment to the fruits of actions. We should not become so attached to the fruits and consequences that attachment begins to guide our actions. We must, for our part, keep reminding ourselves that I am doing this only for Swami. My reward, if any, must come only from Swami. Then Swami will take care that the mind is fed time to time. And of course, whenever that happens, we will have the maturity to think that this is also Swami's prasadam. Right? So that's why he says, Tyaktva karma phalam asangam. Again, this is a definition of a jnani. The jnani does not have any attachment. Forget deep attachment. So why should he say asangam? Because this is a practical tip for you and me. Yes, we cannot completely give up attachment altogether overnight, but at least we can give up deep attachment. When we are low, when we feel that we are unrewarded or we are doing a thankless job, it is our duty to pull ourselves up and say that, but I did not do this so that somebody is going to come and thank me. I did not do this because somebody is going to appreciate me. I did this as my act of placing a flower to Swami, right? So that reminding ourselves is very, very important. And if we really, become sensitive to this, we will find that every time the mind asks for this, it is actually an opportunity for us to remind ourselves that we are doing it for Swami, right? Every time we find, in a team, you're the one who has worked best and you find that somebody else gets the reward, I think it is a moment for us to remind, but I did not do it for the reward. So if he gets it, probably he did it for the reward or she did it for the reward. So let him have it. I did it to please my Swami. And I'm only bothered whether Swami is pleased with me or not. So it becomes an opportunity for us to re-anchor ourselves, recalibrate ourselves. Right? And that's why he says, Nitya tripto nirashrayaha, continuing in that same shloka where he was defining the jnani. A nitya tripta means he is always satisfied. A jnani is always satisfied. He is never looking forward to anything. Nirashrayaha. We will find ourselves moving towards that state, but we are not there, right? We are not eternally satisfied. So we might not be a nitya tripta, but we will see that satisfaction becomes more and more easier as we go through in this path. We may be dejected, but we find that the time we spend with our spirits low is very, very less. We immediately pull ourselves up and say that, but I did not do it for this, right? And that is why, again, this act of offering to God, I think that's the two important takeaways from this episode. One is, spirituality is very simple. There are no gimmicks to it. There are no glamorous states that you have to reach. The states that you have reached are very, very simple. Whatever Swami has been saying, be good, see good, do good. You become a pure individual. You have more control over your senses and your body and your thoughts. You start expressing more love towards all people around you, and you will act according to the situation, but you will not involve your ego into all of that, right? That is one part. And the other one is, the more we are able to do all our actions as an offering to God, the more we will get detached from the consequences, and the more we will be tainted by the consequences of those actions. So those are the verses that we went through today. I thought we'll have time for one more verse, but we did not have the time. We'll anyway continue this. The theme continues. This is only a break that we're taking because we've run out of time. So dear listeners, do join me again next week, 7:30 p.m. for continuation of the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita as part of this Gita series. Thank you all for joining me week after week. I most humbly, just as we spoke, offer this humble effort at Swami's lotus feet. In a short while from now, you'll be joined by Brother Bishu for the last segment of today's Thursday Live, the Vahini Satsang. I'll meet you all again 7:30 p.m. next week. Till then, take care. Jai Sai Ram.